The following interview was recorded for CFRO The Pulse, Vancouver Co-op Radio's daily news show. The Pulse airs Monday to Friday at 7 a.m. on 100.5 FM and streaming live at coopradio.org. Today we'll continue our series talking with the candidates running in this year's federal election in the riding of East Vancouver. Today I talk with Karen Litsky of the PPC, or People's Party of Canada. Hello, Karen Litsky, and welcome to Co-op Radio.
Thank you, James. It's a pleasure to be here.
Usually I would start these interviews with the candidates by asking for an introduction and maybe an outline of some highlights from your platform, and I promise we will get to that. But I couldn't help noticing when I was looking at your campaign website, the photo of your campaign brochure. And I thought, since this week is rather significant regarding the COVID pandemic and the introduction of this new vaccine pass, maybe we could start there. What is the party's position and your position regarding this new vaccine passport and how the COVID pandemic has been handled generally?
We are the only party that stands resolutely opposed to the whole concept of a vaccine pass and to any of the sort of segregation measures that that discriminate against people on one basis or another. You know, these categories are so slippery because right now we think it's such a simple dialogue difference between the vaccinated and the unvaccinated, but with the growing evidence that immunity wanes after vaccination and that boosters are necessary, people who consider themselves fully vaccinated today, next week they may turn out to be unvaccinated. So by the definitions of the moment. So, we really have to deal with this on principle as opposed to on the basis of what we think about this particular crisis. Principles are one of those things, you either have them or you don't. And if you have them, you stick to them even in times of crisis. And we have a constitutional principle of equality and fair treatment, and those are our party principles as well. And there is it's just fraught the very notion that people can be denied service on the basis of some sort of a health status is that's a place we just shouldn't be going at all in my party's view and my own view.
So let's get back to where I initially meant to start the interview. Tell us, please, a little bit about yourself and the People's Party of Canada and some highlights of the party's platform.
Okay, I will start with a little bit about myself, which is complicated. So I spent 25 years at home raising my kids full time, and that's a really awkward thing to present as a career. As I found when I started applying for jobs after my husband retired, I found that's a very awkward block of time to explain the value of in a resume, whether it's in a campaign platform or a job application. But I spent that time avidly volunteering in various parts of the community, particularly in schools. And that was really, I was also worth mentioning on your station in particular, is that I was deeply involved in the cooperative movement for most of the 1990s, where I was the president of first the now defunct Agora Food Co-op on West Broadway. I sort of took that from the, from its death throes to its actual, and sort of provided hospice for it, as the saying goes. And then I joined the board of the East End Food Co-op on Commercial Drive and was the president of that board for a few years. So those are enormous learning opportunities and were also just really interesting exposure to all kinds of issues as the way they hit on the ground in communities, as opposed to being able to discuss them at sort of a theoretical policy level. So in the schools, I was an advocate for effective reading instruction for inner city schools and for disadvantaged students in particular, and got a real face full of union politics, school board politics, Ministry of Education politics, Indigenous politics, and came out of that experience really wanting to not just win on a certain issue, but to change up the conversation so that useful things could be said. The things that needed to be said could be said so that we could get past these sort of turf wars between entrenched and vested interests. Before that time, I was a dietitian. I worked at the cancer agency for a number of years. And then I went and did a master's degree in business administration, after which I had my kids, and stayed home for 25 years. So kind of an unusual career path for an MBA, but there it is. Now, I've always been fairly political. I've wanted to run for office since I was in my 30s, but I could never find a party where there wasn't too much compromise required to fully sign on to their platform. And when Maxime Bernier showed up and I should say that my leanings were always politically left. I was raised in a left-wing family. And we always, my parents were landed immigrants, and they were always a little shy to speak up about their politics, first because they were immigrants and felt a bit vulnerable, and secondly, because we lived in a very right-wing neighborhood. And oddly, when I moved across town to East Vancouver, I thought I would be able to speak freely and found myself instead muzzled, but this time by the judgmentalism of the left. And that occurred sort of within the co-op movement at the neighborhood level, where we were talking about things like downtown East Side issues, which, you know, I've been a member of the Strathcona Residents Association for many years. Obviously we have those conversations a lot. I just found that there were always these entrenched vested interests that were building empires, often on the backs of the vulnerable, and they made efforts to control the conversation and made everybody who had, you know, maybe better solutions in mind, better perspectives. They made us feel bad for speaking out. They bullied us. They silenced us. I've left more than one public meeting on that topic, being a little worried about how the walk home was going to go. When Maxime Bernier, one part of his platform attracted me the most, and that was when he said, "We do not pander to special interests." And I was like, that is the barrier we need to get across to get out of some of these entrenched problems, out of which really, I mean, decades, generations of politicians have built political careers and harvested political currency out of the degradation and desperation of people on the downtown East Side. And it is time to call out that activity, to call out the interests of the people who are, you know, earning salaries, building nice careers, on the basis of these perpetually unmet needs, rather than meeting the needs. So that's really the part of the platform that attracted me as a left winger. And for all that Maxime himself calls it a conservative movement, for all that it represents, it comes out of a split within the Conservative Party, there are a lot of ex-NDPers being attracted to this party. We are the people who were in the NDP because of the principles, because we sincerely wanted to solve the problems that the NDP claims to care about, that, you know, Jenny Kwan talks about in such impassioned and desperate tones all the time. But, you know, she's been our MP or our MLA in this area for, 25 years or something. And it has gotten steadily worse. Like, you will not find anybody on the downtown East Side who says, "Oh, it's been getting better." It has been getting steadily worse. And all that's happening so far is that the politicians are getting better and better at sounding like they care. And it's time to actually care enough to override the dominant narrative whether it's about drug addiction, whether it's about housing, social housing, whatever, and just change up the conversation so that people who are actually barriers to improvement can be gotten out of the way.
Well, let's talk a bit about those issues you mentioned two right off the bat: housing and harm reduction. Can we start with housing? How do we tackle the housing crisis?
Yeah, so there are really two ends to the housing crisis. Of course, the leading edge is often the what's driving prices upward, which is often postulated to be foreign investment, money laundering, cash, development, land use, zoning decisions. And a lot of that falls at the municipal level, a lot of it at the provincial level, and probably also a good bit of it lands at the federal level. At the other end of the spectrum, there is the issue of social housing. And I've been thinking for a long time that there's something off about the discussion of social housing and the desperate urgency with which the need to which it is asserted that there is a need to build more and more and more and to buy up more and more private land and build social housing on it. And one of the things that I know as somebody who's lived in the area where there is a lot of social housing is that there is a distinct lack, and who's known people who live in social housing versus market housing, there is a distinct lack of ability to transition out of social housing. So to be clear, there are probably two main categories of people who go into social housing. One would be people who need temporary refuge from the pressures of having to pay for their housing or to pay market rates. And the other are people who require permanent assistance of some sort because of some inherent challenges that they face. And that can be something as obvious and simple as old age, disability, various health, physical, mental health problems. And there's absolutely no question that many of those people deserve permanent housing support provided by their fellow taxpayers. Why should they not? But the greater complexity is on the side of where there are people who should be able to transition out of social housing and into market housing. And the basic principle is that, and as I've worded it on my flyer, and I'll just read that, the government intrusion into a sector such as housing distorts the market and eliminates precisely the supply that is the most needed. And so when you're in social housing, let's say you're a young family with three kids, and you have in social housing, you have an apartment that is X size. You have, you've got groundskeepers and plumbers and electricians and so on call to help you sort of take care of it. And then if you want to transition into market housing at some point, you probably have to look at paying probably maybe double for your housing and getting less in terms of space or support or whatever. So who's going to make that jump? The government is such a deep-pocketed landlord that no other landlord can compete with that. And so basically that level of supply has totally dried up as the government has increasingly come into that sector. And our party has actually just released a position statement on housing. It's not a full policy, but it's on our website under campaign news. So Maxime announced this at a recent public appearance, where one of the objectives is to actually get the federal government in particular out of the social housing sector, whereas the other parties, they're just making promises of thousands and thousands of units and billions of dollars, using up tons and tons of land, which in the long run, this is simply not sustainable. We have to talk about moving people through and creating, enabling, fostering a market in which everybody can find the housing that they need and afford it, rather than just saying, okay, well, the answer is always for the government to supply more and more.
Well, isn't part of the problem, though, or a big part of the problem, is that people can't afford market housing? I'm not sure I'm getting what it is you're driving at, and with the People's Party's platform. You know, if we let the market decide about housing, you know, they're in it to make as much money as possible, aren't they? What incentive is there to offer a housing that is genuinely affordable for people?
That's really the point. There is zero incentive if the government is offering a competitive product that you cannot hope to compete with. But if you are a person who can wall off a part of your house and create a little suite, whether you are a person who would like to invest in a little apartment building and just sort of as a retirement project, the point at which I became aware of this was when I kept hearing about new developments, and over and over and over again, I found the word luxury. And I thought, why is this word luxury showing up? Why is everybody building luxury housing? Why is nobody building, like, it's always granite countertops. Why is nobody building housing with laminate countertops? Why do you never see a picture of a nice, simple, clean development in which where working people can say, yeah, I feel at home here, and this looks like something I can afford. So the whole point is that people are not in, I think it is a misapprehension to say that to sort of demonize everybody who is a landlord as being in it for all the profits they can make. For many people, it's just a way to leverage the space that they have or the little bit of capital that they have into a stream of income that keeps them afloat. To own one of these little sort of three-story walk-ups where you sort of putter away, renovate the suites as you're able to, and take care of the property. That's a living for a lot of people. That's not profit. It's just another way to make a living. So I think if we get away from demonizing landlords as a class, we can differentiate the ones who are sheer profiteers in the market versus the ones that are actually most likely to create affordable supply. So certainly if you portion off a small part of your house and you put a little mortgage helper in there, if you are going to get a quality of tenant that you can live with, and where that's a sustainable arrangement, the tenants that you might want to attract are going to look at that and say, well, this is like, you know, I don't know, 500 square feet. I can get 1500 square feet for half the price in social housing. So why should I rent this place? And so the people who will rent that place are possibly way lower down in the hard to house category. And then the rental may not be sustainable. So you lose that supply out of the market. It's a niche that where the Airbnb stuff has filled. Like, a lot of people have just found it is not attractive to rent their property in the long term, like to actually create housing. And so instead they are just Airbnb-ing it, which I don't think is necessarily a really positive development for the city, and certainly doesn't help our housing supply problem.
Sadly, our time is short, so we need to move on. But that's a very fascinating discussion I think we've started. But as I say, moving along, you mentioned too about drug policy in the downtown east side. Harm reduction and policing are very much wrapped up together. Where does the party stand on issues such as those?
So we don't have a clear policy on drug policy at this moment. What I will say is that one of the candidates running for us is Mark Emery. He's running in London North, which is his hometown, and he's actually going to be living there, working in a marijuana shop that his brother is opening. And he's a keen member of the party, and so we'll have the benefit of his point of view for formulating our drug policy. One of the things that one of those things that can't be talked about in the drug thing that I will mention is another point on my pamphlet, which is the degree, and I alluded to it earlier, where the prevalence of degradation and despair in the downtown East Side has built a really thriving NGO sector from which a good number of middle-class careers have been launched. And I find that really disturbing. And one of the things that I think we need to see a lot more clearly is the shadow economy that has been created by grant funding, because that creates a stream of funding into the downtown East Side. You've probably heard the allegation that, you know, we call it the poorest postal code in Canada, but probably more money flows through that than most other postal codes. And the reality of these NGOs and the grants is twofold. First of all, it commodifies suffering. So you have like X number of people who are addicted to drugs and requiring extreme assistance with daily living. So of course you can make these very compelling applications for grant money, and when you do that, it's not only that this sustains your sort of savior complex industry, but also this is a stream of income that is outside of democratic control. So that means we can vote in whatever politicians we want on the downtown East Side, or about the downtown East Side, and yet they don't actually control that money. So drug policy, in effect, it takes a lot of the policy decisions of the downtown East Side out of the hands of voters, elected officials, and even the bureaucrats that we employ. And it just creates this sort of shadow government, almost shadow economy, shadow government. And it propagates the problem because that's what keeps the money circulating. And that's an issue that I think we need to be able to talk about. So often it is precisely the people who are employed by those NGOs who, in my experience, attend public meetings, vociferously talk about their harm reduction policies and the need for various policies, whether it be safe supply or whatever is trendy this year. As I've said earlier, bully and shut down anything that might draw attention to the fact that there are better solutions than continuing to just pump money into these middle class jobs.
You mentioned that you, of course, are a mother, and so occurs to me that childcare and education would be important issues for people living in, everywhere, not just East Van. What are your thoughts on helping people with childcare and getting a decent education?
So education is a provincial jurisdiction, and so one of Maxime's principles is actually to get the federal government out of provincial jurisdiction. You know, when people from all three levels of government work together, they basically just go into a room and they agree to cover up for each other's mistakes, and voters end up not knowing who to blame for what happened last time. On childcare, I find this a backwards way to enter into the conversation about how we raise our kids. I find it really weird that it becomes public policy to support having kids and then farming them out to a bureaucratic system to be raised by government officials, in effect, by government officials as soon as possible. I really believe in a strong bond between parents and kids. I mean, the mother-child bond in particular is like the foundation of civilizations, just as the bond between mothers and fathers, the protective impulse, sort of historically the protective role of fathers. These are things that are these are the most powerful forces in nature, almost the most powerful human behavior forces in nature. And this concept of just creating government childcare, cross-country government childcare services costing, you know, they call it $10 a day, but of course, I mean, that's just because you'll pay $10 a day, but it costs billions and billions of dollars. And to me, the overall effect is an emotionally unhappy population, because we have not fostered and nurtured bonds. What I would like to talk about is how do we build an economy in which parents can work while looking after their kids and staying connected to their kids, and kids can be emotionally, nurtured and connected to their families. Just the notion of childcare is just another bureaucracy. I find it a really destructive concept.
As the election nears, we're less than a week away. I'm wondering, well, you mentioned the desire to be a public servant and enter politics, but I'm wondering what, it's an uphill battle and a lot of work to campaign for an election, and only one person is going to win. What are you hoping to accomplish by running in this election?
Well, I alluded earlier to feeling muzzled on the East Side, and I've discovered over the 30 years I've lived here, and of being in innumerable public meetings and organizational meetings and neighborhood meetings, I've discovered that there's always one or two other people who feel the way that I do. And so I have always spoken up. I've always been that person who'll say the unpopular thing in the room. And I've always been happy to do that because other people have more compelling reasons often to stay silent. They maybe, have neighbors who they want to get along, want to keep getting along with, so they don't say anything, or they, in schools, your kid is in that teacher's room, so you're not gonna disagree with that teacher. And I think in running for public office in Vancouver East at this time, what I most want to do is create an opportunity for other people who have these things to say, to speak out. And I want to just say two things. I'm sorry, I don't even know where our time is, but I've always called this being the Greenpeace of social change, where what Greenpeace used to do historically, not what they do anymore, but what they used to do is they would go out and create and do these outrageous acts that nobody could really always ever figure out what the purpose was, other than that it was sort of symbolic. But what they did was they created behind them a large social space within which dialogue could happen. That's how the environment came to be the forefront. That's how we started talking about the military industrial complex. That's how we how people started articulating their values. Behind that was where everything like the natural food movement grew and all kinds of things. So what I'm trying to do right now is be the Greenpeace of social change by creating that space for discussion. There was something else I was going to say after that, and I've forgotten it. It'll come back to me. Sorry.
Well, I'm afraid it'll probably come back to you after we're already done, because sadly we are out of time. But I do want to thank you very much, Karen, for taking the time to speak with us here on Co-op Radio and The Pulse.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate you taking the time and the interest.
That was Karen Litsky, representing the People's Party of Canada and running in the riding of East Vancouver in this year's federal election, which takes place this coming Monday, September 20th. You can follow Karen on Twitter at Karen Litsky. That's Karen, K-A-R-I-N, Litsky, L-I-T-Z-C-K-E. CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.